Today on The Grave Talks, Appalachian Horror. John and his son, Elijah Henderson, have spent their lives growing up in the Appalachian region of the United States, a region known for its traditions, superstitions, and cryptids. Today, we dive into the world of ghosts, cryptids, and the unexplained phenomena that has fascinated John and Elijah throughout their lives, leading them on a journey trying to explain the unexplainable.
Anybody that knows me, and I don't know if you've seen any of our videos, anything like that, any of our interviews. We come from a small mountain town in East Tennessee. You know, we're one of those mountain Appalachian families. And growing up in one of those, you grow up with hearing all sorts of stories about haints and creatures in the woods, things of that nature. You grow up around people who are involved in what they would call now granny witches, you know, these old granny women that do certain spells and rituals. So I've been around it all my life, but I guess what really hooked me is an account that my mother and her people had in the 60s when a Sasquatch was stalking around their property and giving them some harassment. It would follow them home on these old long country roads, and It'd stand up on this hillside just out of sight, and it would walk along the bank, and if they ran down the road, it would run. If they stopped, it'd stop. If they'd walk, it would walk. You know, they'd see the dirt rolling down the hills, and they didn't really know what it was for a while. But over time, it got to where it would follow them further and faster, and got to where it would follow them up on the back porch and try to get in the house. Now, back in the 60s, most houses in that area of the country didn't have door locks, so they would actually have to run in the house and push the stove or the refrigerator in front of the door to try to keep it out. Now, whatever it was, didn't know how to really shake a doorknob and twist it to get in, but this thing would try to get in the house. Then eventually, it commenced appearing in the windows, and they saw it. And then they would see it standing down around by the barn at the lower end of their property. And so they didn't know what it was, and as time progressed, they noticed that some of their livestock was coming up missing. They had hogs disappearing, and they had an uncle of mine who was one of the meanest humans that ever bothered daylight. Wasn't afraid of anything. He took one of my other uncles, who was young at the time, and a cousin down to the barn with him. They hid there. They was going to try to catch who was stealing these hogs. And they waited, and they set a trap. And somewhere along evening time, or after it got dark, they heard the hogs start going just crazy screaming. And then they saw what they said looked like a big ape come loping out of the woods, and it wandered over to the pig, I guess, corral or stalls, and just reached in and grabbed one of those big hogs, the hogs between 250, 300 or more pounds, and just grabbed its legs and threw it over its shoulders. It wrapped it around its neck, and it walked off back into the woods. So this went on for a while, and one of the cousins even was out riding a horse, and he's running down through the field, and it jumped over this creature laying there asleep out in the field. And when the horse jumped over it, it spooked the creature, and the creature jumped up and spooked the horse. And that cousin wouldn't even go back to the fields to ride anymore for a long, long time. So growing up with these tales, and like I said, a lot of these stories about haints really is what piqued my interest and had me really getting into it. You know, I always had a fascination with it. Mm-hmm. But what clinched me as an adult is we were camping at Montgomery Bell State Park in Tennessee. And Elijah, you'll remember this very well. And the park ranger came around to us and told us, hey, at a certain time, when it gets dark tonight, up here at the little amphitheater we've got set up, we're going to be showing a film called The Legend of Werewolf Springs. And Werewolf Springs was an area on the back side of the park called, well, it's actually called Hall Cemetery, Hall Cemetery Road or Hall Springs. But everybody's nicknamed it Werewolf Springs because they claim that when the moon is full sometimes, or even when it's just bright enough to see, if you're out there at dark, you'll see like a werewolf creature crossing across the cemetery. Mm-hmm. But they said that they were going to show a film about this. And we watched that, and we didn't really believe in werewolves, dogmen, things of that nature. We thought, hey, I bet that's a Bigfoot. Somebody's just misidentified. So we decided that we were going to go around there to that side of the park and check it out just to see what was what when we found out the exact location. And it was me and my son, my daughter, my wife, one of my nieces, and maybe my sister and my mother, we all went. We were just walking around. We went over there to that side of the park, and I noticed a little trail going off into the woods. And I said, well, let's jump off here. Let's look in the woods for a minute. And we walked through this little field, and there was like some, oh, I don't know, small, youngish pine trees there. And one or two of them were broke off about waist high. You know, and it's not easy to break over a young pine tree, you know, just snap it like that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, something's come through here. Let's go see if we see anything. We stepped off into the woods, and we noticed after we got about 50 feet in that there was like a semicircle of turkey feathers there on the ground. It looked like something had caught a turkey and had squatted down literally and was just plucking the feathers out of it because it was in a perfect semicircle. As we're sitting there puzzling over, you know, what in the world done this with these feathers, a train went off in the distance and it was coming through, and then it blowed the whistle. And Elijah, what happened next?
What happened next is from out of the distance of the forest, we heard what sounded like an 800-pound wolf start to howl in the distance. And it sounded almost like it was in pain, just a mournful howl. But the sheer volume of the howl, it shook through your chest. You could feel it. And it was frankly terrifying. It, I was like, what, five?
Yeah, five or six, something like that.
And, yeah, we started to book it out of there. And interestingly, or humorously, there was a couple of women jogging in the area, and well, they were actually just hiking in the area, but after they heard that noise, they started running back out of there, and they had a baby and a little carrier strapped onto them, and its head, it looked like a bobblehead there, running so fast trying to get out of there.
Yeah, I thought they was going to break that baby's neck trying to get out of there. It was just bouncing it around, and you know, I'd seen that there was like a troop of Boy Scouts that had, I guess, rented like this little lean-to that's a three-sided cabin lean-to in the woods. Mm-hmm. And they were camping out there, and I was like, well, somebody better run and tell these guys that, you know, if they didn't hear that, that they need to be careful. There's some kind of animal out here.
Yeah.
And I went around, and I went up to the guy who looked like he was in charge, and I was like, sir, did you just hear that? And he was like, no, this is a deaf Boy Scout troop. And they just looked like I was trying to be mean, you know, and
yeah,
didn't want to pay any attention because they thought I was making fun. But, man, it was a very terrifying a noise right there. But it really primed our pump and got us interested in Bigfoot again. And it was years later before we really began to accept the possibility that there might be a cryptid like a dogman or something.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any fear, John, when you're out there, you hear this story that they're going to show this movie, this documentary or this movie about part of the park with something very possibly scary in it, and your reaction is to go and explore that part of the park, which I don't blame you, I understand. But is there any fear going through your mind where you're taking your son and your family and all that, and you're going to go start going into the woods a little bit deeper to explore and possibly identify one of these things?
Honestly, no. I didn't have any, you know. My wife will often tell people that I wasn't born with a healthy sense of fear. That's not exactly true. Years ago, I remember I was in first grade, and I was, you know, staying with my uncle, who did some trapping for a living at the time. And I'd have to go out at night with my cousins, who, my goodness, they were torture mavens at best. I had to go out in the dark with them off in the forest to check and run the traps. And they would get me out there, first grade, and then they'd turn off the lights and run off and tell me there was a monster there and it was after me, and they'd run off and leave me in the woods. And after going through that, you know, I eventually got to where I didn't have much fear of anything.
Sure.
So
Your threshold of fear, your bar is a lot higher than others in terms of environment and where you're at, where what one may be freaked out by. You, it's just like, I've been there, done that, and it's a different definition. That's understandable. I mean, that's just conditioning right there. What about you, Elijah? How were you feeling when you put yourself back there in that mindset of being a 5-year-old little boy? And obviously, you know, you when you're that age and your dad or an adult figure is showing you something or taking you somewhere, you obviously, you know, your dad and, you know, everything and anything is, at that point, can also be normal too. You may not be, you know, so surprised by, you know, where he's taking you or exploring because, you know, he has some interest in some of those things. But what was going through your mind that night when you went out into the woods?
Well, the first time that I heard it, I mean, I guess my mind wasn't really open to the fact that anything like that existed.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing that for the first time, it terrified me for years. I wouldn't even go back into that stretch of woods for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And once we started really getting into Bigfoot research, I mean, I was still very young. I just wouldn't go out with them. I wouldn't go research with them at all. I'd stay back home or just away from it. And it took me many years to really get used to Bigfoot research and anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But once I finally got used to it, I fell in love with it. And now if I hear something in the woods, I just grab a flashlight and just walk off by myself in the woods or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I almost don't have a healthy sense of fear of that kind of thing on my own now. Yeah, I have to tell him, Elijah, if you hear something outside, do not get up and go in the woods without letting us know you're going. You know, if I'm in bed, you know, let somebody know, because you could fall and hurt yourself out there.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going out there after something, at least let me know you're going.
Yeah, I'm to the point now where I hear something huge breaking off in the woods. Oh, see you, Dad. I just start going.
Yeah, we've got one research area where one of these cryptids is alleged to have killed somebody. And, you know, we'll be down there camping out. And I'll have to look around and go, hey, where did Elijah get off to? And then he's way off down in a holler somewhere trying to find it. And I'm like, son, we probably need to stay together here.
How much of the stories, you know, growing up, and I'll ask you this, John, when you were hearing the stories of you know, granny witches and haints and things of that nature, you know, Bigfoots, all of that, how much of it were you processing as, you know, this is old lore, this is superstition, you know, it's part of the fabric of where you grew up, of your world, of the culture, you know, and very, you know, well believed for many generations. But as you were coming up, how are you processing all that? Were you believing that those things is real until you started to experience some of them? Or were you just kind of going, you know, these are fun stories of my, you know, where I grew up?
Well, I always accepted it as absolute truth,
okay.
And I'll tell you a couple reasons why.
Yeah.
You know, I knew that granny witches was a thing because when I was very little, I was real sick with, have you ever heard of thrush? Some people call it thrash.
No.
It's almost like a fungus or something that'll grow in your mouth.
Okay.
I couldn't eat. My mouth hurt. It's very sore. It's down my throat.
Yeah.
The doctors couldn't seem to cure it. And my mama took me to an old granny woman. And that woman, she took me in her arms and she cupped her hand and she blew into my mouth 7 times. And within just a day or so, I was healed. You know, so I've seen these things like this happen, you know, and I would hear the adults talking about how they had done some kind of a spell or something, or somebody had done a spell and caused somebody to wreck their car or done something to keep somebody away.
Yeah.
And I know, being just very little, they was in a, we'd be out or something around a campfire, and a whippoorwill would start hollering.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd reach for the salt shaker, and they'd throw salt in the fire, and it would make this whippoorwill stop hollering for whatever reason, you know. And so I've seen them do weird things, you know, growing up. So I always just accepted it as true. And I never at that age had seen a creature. But we'd be at my Aunt Myrtle's house, you know. She was like the family depository for kids while other people's families, you know, were working and stuff like that. Aunt Myrtle would keep us. And she lived way out in the country. And we'd go outside and we'd play through the day. And, you know, sometimes there'd be something bizarre off in the woods hollering. We didn't know what it was, and they didn't really have a name for it, but they'd just say, look, you kids stay home, you know, or y'all stay here close to the house today. Don't y'all go in the woods today. There's a Bob Wouster out there. Y'all stay close to home. And we never knew what a Bob Wouster was growing up. But now that I'm grown and I've researched and things of that nature and record whoops, howls, hollers and such, I know exactly what it was. It was a Sasquatch. But them being country people didn't know what to call it, so they just would make a name up for it. And I've always been around bizarre things. Again, out at Myrtle's one time, you know, we were just really, really little, and we were out in near one of the old cow pastures playing. There's like a big old mud puddle out there, and a lot of us were gathered there making mud pies and just playing in mud and dirt like little poor dirty kids do out in the country. And my cousin Ginger, who was just a little bit older than me, probably 2 or 3 years older than me, we were out there and we was muddy as a bunch of little hogs, and she come walking out of the forest, and she was wearing a white dress, had white stockings on, things like that, just looked like she was gussied up for church. And she kept trying to get us to come off into the woods and play with her, you know, and we were just having fun doing what we were doing. We just ignored her, but she kept trying to pressure us to come into the woods further and play with her. And we're just like, no, 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 go on, go on. And she turned around and she left, went back into the woods. But we kept playing, and when we finished, we went back to the house. And when we got there, we saw a car coming down the road. It was the car that the adults had, and they were coming back from town. And when they pulled up and stopped, who do you suppose got out of the car? Ginger. Ginger hadn't even been there all day.
Yeah.
So we never knew what that was. So growing up, there's a lot of weird bizarrities, you know, that went on. Everybody had a ghost story. Everybody had encountered a Hank, you know, or things like that, you know. We had one family member who I won't call names, because if their family ever heard this, it would hurt them very bad, who almost nightly had a supernatural problem, because they said that there would be this thing that looked like a hog, a hairy hog, that would come and stand at the foot of the bed and then crawl up and start strangling him. And they had this thing assault them almost nightly. And they attributed to the fact that they had made a pact with the devil to sell their soul in exchange to for someone that they were in love with.
Mm-hmm.
And went on, they were harassed like this for many years.
It's interesting that part of the country has so many things. I mean, it's not just like one thing. It's not just ghost stories. You have the Bigfoots. You have what you were talking about with the granny witches. You have the Haints. Then you have the people who have had the pacts with the devil. I want to talk about, there's just so many areas we can go down here, and we'll probably touch on several of them. What I'm curious about here, and since we're on this one right now, and then we'll move on to another one. When you have that superstition that some may look at it as, or a legitimate thing where someone has made a pact with the devil and then had to deal with that sort of torment every single night. I guess my initial question is, how does one go about making a pact with the devil? And that may sound somewhat humorous or sarcastic, but I'm not being that way with that question at all. Is it just kind of one of those things where someone, you know, they have the lover, they want that, they so want to be with them? Is it done as simplistically as, look, if you can make this happen, almost like kind of praying, saying it out loud, you know, I will be yours? Or is there more of a ritualistic type thing that needs to go on for someone to fall into that sort of a situation?
I believe there's more of a ritual to go on with that. Okay. I don't know what it was, because a lot of these women who practice that type of magic, they kind of keep it amongst themselves, and they don't share it. They pass it down daughter to granddaughter and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's been a few people who've actually seen some of the books that they have. I actually have a church member that I go to church with who, his aunt, his mother's sister, actually was involved in, I guess, a type of this granny magic, but it was down around Mississippi. And she literally had a book, a black tome, that had a warning on it: whosoever opens this book will forever separate themselves from Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some pacts that do go along with it, you know, and then some of the people that practice this magic, or they almost do a blend of magics, like Cherokee magic with almost a Dutch magic, which they call powwow.
Mm-hmm.
And others will, because there's a pretty interesting Dutch book, you know, on magic that combines scripture and Celtic magic and I think Cherokee magic, called The Long Lost Friend.
Mm-hmm.
Or powwow. And so there's different strains of this magic that people use. But yes, I think there is an actual ritual that goes with some of that bartering your soul.
Yeah.
You know, one of my aunts, you know, she had different potions and things that she could do. Before I get to that, another aunt of mine, I was talking to her one day and I was like, you really practice this magic? I said, could you hurt somebody with it? She's like, well, sure. I absolutely could kill somebody with it. I just don't, because I don't want to go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
So she thought she was practicing some sort of magic that wouldn't lead her down to hell unless she used it wrong. And others are just very, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Pumpkinhead or not, but that old witch woman on there, there's some that's just about as mean as that old lady was.
Yeah.
You know, it just depends on how deep and dark they want to go with it. But one aunt that I had, she had a jar that she kept that, you know, she'd got the recipe from up in the hills and hollers. It was literally a bunch of insects that was crushed together, and I don't even know what variety of insects it was, but she could take these insects and lace what you were eating or drinking with it. And without you knowing it, if you ate it, you would die, and they wouldn't even be able to tell what killed you.
Wow. Let me ask you this. I mean, and there's probably no statistic on this, but it's more so just knowledge of the area. When you have individuals like that, the quote-unquote granny witches, are there more folks who are like that today that are using it for good than bad, where it's a vehicle for helping? Whereas you use that example of the ailment that you were afflicted with as a child, and you went and saw someone and you were healed. So they were using this power, they were using this vehicle they had to help and to heal. But when used in the wrong direction, like a car, you know, you can use a car to get to the grocery store. You can also use a car to run over people at a festival. It's a car nonetheless. But it can certainly be used for the wrong reasons. Are there more people using it for good and to help versus bad? What would your opinion be there?
Well, truthfully, I think it's a dying art.
Okay.
I couldn't point to a legitimate granny witch anymore.
No.
I know there's a few who probably have learned a trick or two from some relative or something.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as what used to be, I just don't see it anymore. And I don't want to call it a gift, but more than an ability.
Yeah.
But I don't see it anymore the way that it used to be done. You know, we live in a society where everybody's watching Buffy and Charmed, and it's trendy to be in a Wiccan or something like that, you know, but it's, mm-hmm. and they get out and they dabble with things, but it's nothing like what it used to be. It used to be a serious thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's because of people brought a lot of these customs over. You know, most of the people in Appalachia, or a great majority of them, actually come from Ireland and Scotland, you know, and they brought a lot of the Celtic magic with them when they came over here.
Sure.
And, you know, they intermingled with American Indians, you know, and sort of blended that magic in with their own.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you had the religious people who even blended, you know, scripture in with that. You know, my grandpa, he used to hemorrhage in really bad from his ears, his nose, his mouth, and his eyes. You know, I don't know what he had. Somebody said he had something called Bright's disease. I don't know if that's true or not. But he couldn't read a lick. But he, when he would hemorrhage, he would go to a woman across the street and he'd take his Bible to her, and she would read Ezekiel 16:6 to him. And it would stop him from hemorrhaging. And she finally taught him to follow along with it in his Bible. So if he started bleeding bad at home, he could get his Bible down and read that passage to himself, and the hemorrhaging would stop. And, you know, for years they had his old Bible, and it had blood stains where he would get it down and read to stop the bleeding.
When you look at these things as an adult, and you were, it sounds like a child when these things were going on, as an adult, and you look at that sort of a case, that specific one where he read the Bible and then a very specific verse in the Bible, and then the hemorrhaging would go down. What goes through your mind? Are you thinking, well, that's just an interesting coincidence, and, you know, it just happened to be because he was focusing his mind and kind of calming it and going over here and reading this, and it was kind of a placebo effect? Or do you think there was something actually going on, some sort of a spiritual healing of some sort that was causing him to have the hemorrhaging get better or to subside?
I believe now that I'm a grown man and I've studied different things for years on my own, I'm a Christian, hardcore Christian, but sure. I believe that portion had really nothing to do with witchcraft. I believe that was just simply an act of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Bible, Jesus said, "Be it unto you according to your faith."
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some people might say that's the law of attraction. I don't know, but I believe that, you know, when Jesus says, "Be it unto you according to your faith," you know, that's what he meant.
Okay. Let me ask you this too, because I'm very curious with all of these things that are out there, and depending on the version of Christianity or religion that one has their faith in, obviously the topic of paranormal, ghosts, Bigfoots, you name it, all of that whole ball of stuff, is, as you know, either looked upon as it could not exist, it doesn't exist, it exists, don't dabble with it, or this all can kind of intertwine somehow. How does it work for you? And this is an opinion-based question. I want to understand, being a man of strong faith and of your beliefs, how does all of the things from the Bigfoots to Haints to granny witches to all of that intermingle with your belief system of Christianity? I'm just curious how all of that connects. I know there's plenty of ways in the Bible where a lot of this stuff is referenced. But then you have, like I said, a lot of versions of this where it's just don't talk about it. How does it all kind of come into this full circle for you?
Well, it's pretty easy for me, you know. For me, I believe that the Bible is the acid test for everything.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had it lead me wrong. the Bible forbids dabbling with some things, you know, and then other things, you know, I don't see as being a problem. Like Bigfoot, I don't believe that Bigfoot is any sort of mythical monster. I think it's probably just some sort of undocumented animal.
Sure.
Now, if you get into Dogman or something like that, again, I don't know how to explain it because, in my mind, we've been taught that it shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
But, you know, who's to say that God don't like a wide variety of different unique animals, you know? I don't believe they're supernatural. I don't believe they're werewolves. But I believe that most of the cryptids are just some sort of undocumented animal.
Okay.
You know, some of the more bizarre things, I think it might be demonic activity, you know, trying to get people's mind captured deeper into the occult.
Mm-hmm.
Scripture, you know, tells you that the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. So me and Elijah, we believe that there aren't actual ghosts, you know, what people think of as a haint,
mm-hmm.
but demonic entities that do certain things.
Talk.
You know, so we tend to shy, or not really shy away, but we give a wide berth to things that we believe are actually of a supernatural nature.
And we try not to really get hands-on and investigate it.
We don't do EVPs and things like that. We did accidentally record an EVP one time without even trying.
Mm-hmm.
So don't really know. Other than demonic activity, how to account for it.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with John and Elijah Henderson about Appalachian horror. In part two of our conversation, we're going to ask what John believes a haint is and how exactly does he define it. What is a fetch and what type of bad things can come along when seeing one? How does John believe that a ghost of a spirit of a once living person can coexist into the ecosystem of religion? Does John believe that demonic entities can take the form of terrifying beasts in the forest? All that and more in part two of our conversation. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. You can do it by going to patreon.com/thegravetalks or our website directly, thegravetalks.com, and clicking Become a Gravekeeper. $5 a month gets you access to every single interview, part one and part two, hundreds to binge away on, and advanced episodes of our program, all commercial free, all there for you to enjoy. That's how we support our program and keep it on the air. To find out more about John and Elijah's work, you can find the Cryptid Studies Institute page on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.